Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by CharlottesGotALot.com. The Queen City is a food lover's paradise and hosts hundreds of incredible events throughout the year, including the International Symposium on Bread. Plan your trip at CharlottesGotALot.com.
Hey, this is Hannah, HRN's program manager. It's HRN's 10th anniversary and now our summer fun drive. So show your support for independent, revolutionary, entertaining food radio by becoming a monthly recurring donor. HRN is powered by a passionate community of thoughtful eaters, and we need each and every one of you to show your support so that we can keep bringing you your favorite food podcasts. It takes a village, and every dollar donated, every listener tuning in is essential to our continued success. So set up a donation for $10 every month. You'll show us that you want to be a part of a bright future for HRN. And you'll get one of our brand new limited edition Pizza Pocket t-shirts. So snag your new favorite tea and show us some love, all for the price of about two fancy lattes each month. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today, and thank you.
Good evening, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liut, and we're broadcasting from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. So today is a really, really, really big day for all of us at Eating Matters, because it's the first time in over 3 years that our listeners get to hear from our show's creator, Kim Kessler. Since handing over the reins of Eating Matters, she has been serving as the Assistant Commissioner of the Bureau of Chronic Disease Prevention and Tobacco Control at the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. She's joining the show today to help shine a light on the innovative and impactful work coming out of this agency in their effort to promote and protect the health of all New Yorkers. And before we actually get started, I should probably disclose two things. The first is that I had the immense honor of working for Kim many years ago. And prior to that, I also worked at the New York City Health Department. So you might think that I'm totally biased in my unbridled enthusiasm for and pride in what they're doing today. And that is because I am. But as you will soon hear, their work truly speaks for itself. So without further ado, Kim, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jen.
Is it kind of crazy where our seats are literally...
Yeah, we're in opposite seats.
Yeah. I'm the captain
you're
now.
You're the official host. I couldn't even remember how to put these earphones on. It's crazy.
And did that music sound good to you?
Yes.
You want to share why?
Yes, the music sounded good to me because it is my husband. It is written and produced and performed by my husband, Tim. So it's always fun for me to hear.
It is. It's a good one.
He doesn't have enough lyrics about food, I guess. So I think later he talks about meatballs in that song. Must have been the thinking at the time.
Maybe. I think it's perfect. Okay. So not only are you show creator, but you also music curator. You do it all.
Add the titles.
You really do it all. So why don't you... tell us, like, what does it mean? What do you, to be an assistant commissioner at the health department? What are you working on?
Yeah, so it is a fun, exciting, and busy job. I oversee the work of the Bureau, where we focus on the leading contributors to chronic disease, and that really means tobacco, diet, unhealthy diets, and physical inactivity. Mm-hmm. In addition, we have more cross-cutting efforts, particularly trying to leverage clinical environments for opportunities for public health. So we work to train providers on public health opportunities. We work to promote cancer screening and the cancers where it can make the biggest difference, so colorectal cancer and breast cancer. Across all of those efforts, we're doing a lot of communication, research, and evaluation, which is core to our work.
Wow.
It's exciting.
I mean, it's really exciting. And also, I feel like you just said, we do everything.
We don't do everything. We focus in within there where we think we can make the biggest difference with the resources that we have. But it's been interesting for me because I had previously focused on food exclusively. And so taking on this broader portfolio and seeing lots of the ways that our approaches align across those different content areas has been a really exciting way to learn and think in new ways about food as well as tobacco or active design and even beyond.
How are the priorities kind of determined, especially since, I mean, when I think about like diet related interventions, there's still a lot of, there's some debate within some topics within the kind of dietetic community in and of itself. So how, like, you know, who's making these decisions on what priorities and initiatives lead?
You know, I think actually when you think about healthy eating, it's really not that complicated, and it's actually fairly straightforward. And we know that along with tobacco, it is really one of the leading contributors to premature mortality and the conditions that lead to premature mortality. And I think that if you asked most people, probably all the people sitting out there eating right now, they'd be able to tell you, I should be eating fruits and vegetables, I should be cutting back on my salt and sugar, and they actually know what to do, but it's knowledge doesn't equal behavior change because we're in an environment that makes it really hard to act on that, and it's harder for some than for others. So
especially at Roberta's Pizza.
Maybe not especially, but at Roberta's Pizza, among many other places you could put yourself in New York City.
Right.
So I think that in general, in terms of our priorities, you know, when we are focused on helping people to eat more fruits and vegetables, eat more whole foods, cut back on sugary drinks, cut back on sodium, and that is pretty consistent and pretty well established across the science and public health community, that those are the areas to focus on. I think a lot of the confusion that comes up around nutrition is really driven by industry, mm-hmm. where they're stirring the pot and putting framing messaging that can make it more challenging for people to really act on the things that would be more helpful for their diet. So in terms of priority setting, what we really have to think about are the kinds of interventions that we can do, mm-hmm. And then what the potential opportunities are to take action for shaping the food environment. And those are things like price or the retail setting or taxes or education, among many others. And mm-hmm. then looking at the kinds of resources and tools that we have, which are policy, education, programmatic efforts, convening or partnering with stakeholders, and then see where the matches are. So we may, for example, mm-hmm. we would be really interested in seeing a sugary drink tax because we would expect that to be, it's the most promising type of intervention for reducing sugary drink consumption, and sugary drinks are
bad.
They are bad.
They're not great.
Summarizing that
so
well. but yes, they are.
I'm good at this.
They are the leading source of sugar in Americans' diets. They are all around us. They're often served in large portions. They're tied to diabetes and linked with heart disease and weight gain. So we've had a long-standing priority on trying to reduce consumption. At the same time, that is not something that New York City can do on its own authority. That's something that where the authority is at the state level. So it's not something that we can act on. So it's really looking across what are the types of interventions that are promising, mm-hmm. and where do we have a unique ability and the right resources to take action.
So it sounds like that's a lot of kind of connecting the dots to find a, you know, specific policy or program that you can kind of. There's a lot of legwork that has to go into that up front. So let's continue talking about sugar-sweetened beverages. There's a lot that the city has tried to do in the past, right, over the past, like, 10 years. What is happening? And, I mean, at least when we were there, I would say there didn't have as much success in terms of a tax or portion control or, you know, like the SNAP, proposed SNAP pilot to not include sugary beverages. So what is happening right now? What do you guys, you know, what are you guys doing on that?
So, so as you say, the city has had a longstanding, or as we have both said, the city has had a longstanding focus on this, and there's been a whole set of efforts to tackle them. And that has included things like the city food standards, which helped to ensure that cities weren't serving or providing sugary drinks in any of their programming or in their settings.
And actually, before you go on, so I think, can you just tell us how many meals and, you know, and how many people that affects? Because in a city of 8 million people.
In a city of 8 million people, over 1 million of them are city school children. And all of those children are impacted by these city food standards. So they are the biggest group. Mm-hmm. But the city serves about 240 million meals and snacks per year through all of its programming. So DOE is the biggest piece. But there's our public hospitals. There's our correctional facilities. There's our homeless shelter, senior centers, after daycare programs.
And others, and more.
And so in all of those settings, the city has established nutrition standards with strong criteria so that we're ensuring that we're walking the walk mm-hmm. in the food that we're serving and working with city agencies to, especially for many of those programs that are serving more vulnerable New Yorkers or young and our senior communities.
It's just a huge impact, a huge opportunity.
It's a huge opportunity, and when we make those kinds of changes, it can also send signals to the supply system. So if we have sodium thresholds that are lower, if we're requiring certain amounts of whole grains to be served, that can help move the supply chain to make access to those kinds of products more available in the food service sector. So that's an example of
healthier standards.
Healthier standards,
yeah.
Including for vending machines and other outlets.
Oh yeah, I know vending machines.
You know vending machines.
Yeah.
You worked hard on that, Jenna. we also have had media campaigns for a longstanding focus.
Yep.
In terms of getting information out to people about sugary drinks, what they are, and how they can affect health.
And those have included like the I feel like those really resonated. The Subway ads, like the pouring on the fat campaign. That were super gross.
Pouring on the pounds,
pouring on the pounds, and then just like showing the amount of sugar that is, you know, actually like in a teaspoon or sugar cubes.
Yeah, packets. I think there was media campaigns around packets. We'll often talk about teaspoons. Like one 20-ounce sugary drink can contain 15 teaspoons of sugar, and some are even higher.
Oh.
So just trying to bring some of that down to reality and help people understand and how it's linked with health. There's also been where we regulate environments. So daycares and after school programs aren't allowed to offer sugary drinks. And we've also done a lot of nutrition education and outreach around this. And we work with community partners on sugary drink awareness. And together, along with many of the policy attempts, although they weren't always successful, as you have talked about. So things like...
You're like, thanks for pointing that out.
it's important. So we've tried to pursue different things, including bringing attention to the issue of taxes back in 2009, 2010, the portion cap attempt. And while those didn't go into effect, I think they're really important for driving the conversation and helping people to see the connection between policy and... how that affects what people are eating. And over all of that time, we have seen reducing rates in sugary drink consumption or self-reported sugary drink consumption in New York City, which is promising. And at the same time, we still have about a quarter of New Yorkers drinking one or more sugary drink per day.
Wow, really?
And some of the numbers are high for youth. For youth, it's about a third for kids in high school. A third of them drinking a sugary drink per day. And what's even more concerning is that there's also really big gaps between groups. So we have white New Yorkers consuming less sugary drinks than communities of color, mm-hmm. and we recognize that that's tied back to marketing presence and retail landscapes in different communities. And so there are a lot of factors to consider and to tackle when mm-hmm. we're trying to address this issue.
Has the city done, what are the efforts that the city has made in attempt to, if any, regulate like what can be marketed where?
So because of the First Amendment, there are real limitations.
This little thing, you might have heard of it. It's called the First Amendment.
It's called free speech.
Yeah.
And
you're a lawyer. You know a lot about that.
And free commercial speech. So there are limitations on how marketing can be restricted. And in our country, unlike some others, there are some places across the world that are really tackling the issue of marketing. It's more challenging to do that in the U.S.
But there are communities where, you know, you, for instance, I mean, I thought, like, you can't have, I don't know, like a Taco Bell ad in school or something like that. Or like a big banner, you know, like what, I mean, there have to be some
There
examples.
Are, well, school, because schools are, a school can have a policy around that. Or in New York City, for example, our school vending machines can't promote a sugary drink product.
So they can't be like a Pepsi machine.
Correct.
Yeah.
And they aren't.
Okay. Okay. So now that you guys have sugar taken care of, or is in the works, what about sodium?
The focus for us is thinking about the food supply, and that's where the real opportunity is, because for most people, it's really not what you're adding at the table. And if you're cooking up a lot of vegetables and sprinkling some salt on top, that's not what's driving the fact that 50% of Americans are consuming 50% more sodium than they should.
Okay.
So the daily recommended limit, or the threshold at which you really start increasing your risk of links to high blood pressure, is 2,300 milligrams per day. And that's the national guideline. And that's about a teaspoon of salt. New York City was a leader by creating and launching the National Salt Reduction Initiative, mm-hmm. where the city, along with a coalition of public health partners all across the country, developed voluntary sodium targets for industry. And this was targets that industry could then look at what they actually had in their own packaged foods and make efforts to either reformulate or change their products or introduce new products so that their products were at a lower sodium level. And this is the kind of thing that is invisible to the consumer, so it's making the healthy choice easier without people even having to think about it.
Right.
And then more recently, the city...
I mean, and that was a really big deal, right? So you have like all of the major, most of the major big food CPGs signing on to say in like XYZ product, we're going to lower the sodium. And then they did it phase in over time?
Yes. So there were two targets. There was a shorter and nearer term target and a longer term target. And the city did work to work with companies and invite them to commit to those targets publicly. And at the same...
they were like, we welcome
you. We welcome you. And a number of them did. And a number of them made real strides. And then we did an overall... evaluation of that initiative, and there was a reduction in sodium in the food supply by 7% over the course of the NSRI initiative.
Wow.
And we're also excited that since that time, the FDA has been working on sodium targets and are optimistic that those targets will be finalized. It's a...
Sodium, what do you mean sodium targets?
Sodium reduction targets for the food industry. So these again would be voluntary targets, but uh-huh. this kind of guideline setting really does help set a level playing field among industry and inform what's a way of shifting the overall food supply to something that's more in line with what we need for health.
So this seems like it might be a really good example of how a local policy has helped drive or like encourage, you know, more federal action.
Yeah, I think it's a great example of that. And I should say that the team that developed this was looking internationally. So it's a good example also of how we learn from other jurisdictions, whether they're local or international. This was something that the UK had done, and there wasn't action at the federal level at the time. New York City took it on. So again, along with many, many partners, a coalition of partners from across the country, New York City was able to lead that effort and then ultimately, yes, help to shape federal policy or help to inform it.
Yay, DOHMH.
Yeah.
I have to ask, because I have gotten this question. There was a study that came out, and you can help me with this, but was it 2018 that kind of basically questioned whether or not sodium was as damaging to our health as was previously thought. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I'm sure the department has a response.
There have been a number of studies that have, and I would say actually, there have been some studies, and there tends to be heavy media coverage of studies. Lots of studies with lots of confusing information, I think, generated sometimes by media coverage of them. But salt, I think, has sometimes been portrayed as a more controversial topic than the science would actually bear out. So the science is clear that sodium can increase your high rates of sodium consumption can increase blood pressure. And high blood pressure is linked with health outcomes that we want to help people avoid, like heart disease and stroke. And it's really not controversial. It's a national guideline. There was just a major analysis done that reconfirmed the guideline of 2,300 milligrams per day.
Okay, so we have to take a really quick commercial break and hear a word from our sponsors. But when we get back, we'll have a little bit of time for just a couple more questions. So stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by CharlotteSgotALot.com. The Queen City is a food lover's paradise and host to hundreds of incredible events throughout the year, including the International Symposium on Bread at Johnson & Wales University. HRN went to this year's symposium to learn about the science, history, and art of bread making. Here's what visitors had to say about the symposium.
I love the geeky science stuff.
Great food. Love the Armenian pizza.
How much I'm eating and consuming the carbs.
The most interesting thing is just the community.
For me, it's the science of starters.
So much information.
Very inspiring so far, because everybody has a different outlook.
I'm not technically a breadhead, but I think I'm going to be one after being here. So whether you're a breadhead or just a curious mind, check out HRN on Tour for coverage of Charlotte's International Symposium on Bread and an insider's look into Charlotte's food scene. Don't miss our interview with Peter Reinhardt and Kristen Moore to learn more about where to eat on your next trip to Charlotte, a city on the rise. Learn more at charlottesgotalot.com.
And we're back, where today I am joined in the studio by Eating Matters founder, Kim Kessler, current Assistant Commissioner of the Bureau of Chronic Disease Prevention and Tobacco Control, who is also the smartest, most amazing person I know, public health official and food policy warrior. So lucky to have her in my life. And so anyways, we're talking with Kim today.
Thank you, Jenna.
Oh, you're welcome. Okay, so
definitely can't live up to that, but
I think you can. What are some new things that you guys are working on right now that you're particularly excited about?
Well, I spoke just now about the National Salt Reduction Initiative and the department's past work on that, because you were so interested in hearing about sodium.
I know, you changed my mind.
But
amazing.
This gives me the opportunity to highlight a new effort in that area. So the National Salt Reduction Initiative is now the National Salt and Sugar Reduction Initiative. And it's a really exciting effort.
Yeah.
We worked with the national partnership that we have that is convened by us and made the determination to set targets
for the existing
coalition, yes, and made the determination to go ahead and set voluntary targets for sugar in the packaged food supply. It's very present in our food supply, perhaps more than people would realize. Added sugar is actually in about 7 out of 10 packaged food products in the U.S.
Wow.
And added sugar is something like sodium that Americans consume too much of. We consume about 35% more than the recommended amount. And like sodium, it is linked with bad health outcomes.
Yeah.
So this is an effort to, again, look to the food supply and try and make a difference before products reach consumers. And what we are doing now, we're in the early phases of this. We've released an initial set of targets. Our targets are to reach for asking companies to reduce sugar by 20% in packaged food products, and then by 40% in sugary drink products. And those draft targets were shared publicly in October, And then we asked for comments from the industry to help inform this target setting process. And we are currently reviewing those comments. And then we will be sharing an updated set of targets for more further industry engagement.
So, okay. So this is just added sugar or like overall sugar?
So because we don't currently have added sugar on our food labels, though we will soon, which is really exciting.
I know, I'm super excited.
This initiative is based on all sugar in terms of the analysis that we did, but it is designed to really reach added sugar because the types of products, the types of categories that we're setting targets for, there's very little naturally occurring sugar.
For example,
things like cereals or cakes or baked goods. There's also yogurts, sugary drinks, a whole host of other categories. There are some naturally occurring sugars in dairy-based products. Mm-hmm. And there's also naturally occurring sugars in anything that contains fruit. But all of the sugars that are in these products are going to be added sugar. So the way that the targets are designed, we think we'll really be reaching added sugar.
And so, you know, you said like reducing the sugar in sugary drinks, and I'm like, well, doesn't that like defeat the purpose of having a sugary drink? But I mean, I think it's maybe important to point out, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's not just soda. Like, you know, I mean, it is things probably like Snapple products.
Yes.
I hope they're not a sponsor.
No, it is really important to point that out. Thank you for pointing that out, because we think, yes, often people may be picturing soda, but there's a whole host of sugary drinks. There's things like juice drinks, coffee drinks, sweet teas, sports drinks, and all of these can be high in added sugar. And there is a wide range of sugar in different sugary drink products. Of course, we would want people to avoid all sugary drink products. They have little to no nutritional value.
You're like, just drink water.
Yeah.
Just do it.
Yes, just drink water. That is the best thing that you can do.
Put a little lemon in it. It's delicious.
So at the same time, we in consistent with the type of approach that the National Salt and Sugar Reduction takes, it's really about shifting the food supply. So again, this isn't reliant on consumer behavior change or consumers making choices. It's so that what's around you when you go into the store is actually that much more healthy, and you have some more real choices to choose something better for your own health.
So creating a healthier environment.
Yeah, and a healthier food supply.
And it makes it easier. So you don't have to think. It's like you make the healthy choice the easy choice.
How did I get through this interview without saying that?
Yeah. That was our motto.
Very important.
I guess it was the city's motto. It was not just our personal motto. But
yeah, I think it's a motto in public health in general, but it really captures the idea.
I just attributed it to only New York City. We did it. okay, so that's really exciting. Cannot wait to follow the progress on that. Anything else? Not anything else. You guys are doing so much work, but is there anything else that you know?
We do. We have some other really exciting initiatives. We actually just last week announced an expansion of a prescription program that links pharmacies to farmers markets. People who go into a pharmacy and have hypertension can be eligible in these participating pharmacies to get a prescription for health bucks. Then they can take their prescription to the farmer's market and get $30 in health bucks. And health bucks are coupons that are redeemable at farmer's markets for fruits and vegetables. So this is a way for people who are lower income and being treated for hypertension to have their pharmacists engage them in a conversation about lifestyle modification. Mm-hmm. We think pharmacists can play a really important role and are an asset in the community for promoting health, and one that maybe has been under-tapped in the past for these kind of initiatives. And they can engage them, they can share the prescription, and then that person can go to the farmer's market and get those vouchers to help them buy $30 more of fruits and vegetables.
That's amazing.
And every time they go back to get their prescription refilled, they can get another $30.
Is this
set of coupons
just for SNAP recipients, or how do you determine who's in the program?
The screen is based on Medicaid participation, but it is funded by USDA, and it is targeted at SNAP participants. So yes,
I think that's brilliant. Sidebar. I love there's two pharmacists, and they've been my pharmacist for like over a decade, and they're like, I love it. It's one of those kind of, you know, I have like a connection to like a neighborhood, you know, they're not a business owner, but like I see them every
all
the time.
Right. I think that's a common experience. And many pharmacies, especially in low income communities, are independent pharmacies, and they really, you know, can be a place where people have a real connection. It's somebody who is able to provide that bit of guidance that can make a difference and support people in making healthier changes along with the medication that they're accessing. So we're excited about that. It was a program expansion. It started as a pilot, and it's now available in 16 pharmacies across New York City, and there's a little over 800 New Yorkers who've been participating in the program.
Is that like a CVS, or is that a...
It's actually just at independent pharmacies.
Oh, awesome.
At this time.
Oh, that's great. Okay.
So we're excited about that. Yeah. And then another big thing that's happened in New York City is that the mayor announced an effort actually around procurement, so around our city food purchases. He announced that the city is committed to reducing our beef purchases by 50% and then phasing out processed meat. And we will be implementing the processed meat changes by updating the New York City food standards, which I talked about earlier.
Yeah. Wow. By 50%?
Yep. And this is an exciting initiative because it's really at the point of intersection between it's harnessing the importance of both health and the climate. And so he announced this as part of his Green New Deal efforts. And it's really recognizing that there is this intrinsic connection between our food system and our sustainability concerns and climate over the long term. There has been movement all across the country towards featuring more plant-based products, more plant-based proteins, helping people to understand how to incorporate more, eat more plants in their diet in general. We know people usually are eating enough protein in the United States, but it's often just not from the healthiest sources of protein. And so this is really a way that we can start to shift that. And processed meat in particular, there is often high in sodium, high in fat. It's linked with colorectal cancer. So it really is important that we prioritize this. And the city's made a big commitment in this way.
Wow. Okay. So what, that's really, I can't wait to see that. And I'm very impressed and excited about this. All right. So we have to wrap up in, quick in a few minutes, but, I just want to ask a couple more questions. If you had to pick one, this is going to be the section of the interview where I'm like, just pick one of these things. It's like these kinds of questions are impossible to answer. So let me ask you a bunch of them. What is the most impactful, pick one intervention that has come out of the city's health department in the past 10 years? Chronic disease prevention, I would say specifically, that you can say, like, this has been the biggest success.
In New York City, since the time that there really became a big focus on what kind of levers could this city have, there's been a whole host of initiatives that have helped to influence other localities and helped to influence ultimately the federal government. So things like menu labeling, things like sodium reduction that we already talked about. And possibly one of the most impactful examples may be the trans fat restriction.
Yes.
The city's trans fat restriction, which was enacted, I think, in 2006. So it's actually even a longer time frame.
Mm-hmm.
Our Board of Health adopted a restriction to phase out trans fats in New York City restaurants. And so there have been some recent evaluations with more data even showing the impactfulness of that effort. And that's a really strong example of the kind of change that can happen at the local level. And then ultimately in 2015, the FDA added trans fats to its, or removed trans fats from its GRAS list so that they're now much, much less available in our food supply and ultimately will be largely eliminated from our food supply.
Okay. All right. So just like shining a light on the, on the importance of food and how you can make a big difference in, public health and the environment, all these things. And then really leading on an example, like leading on an issue that led that caused trans fats to be removed from our
Yeah, I think it's that opportunity to scale that can make this work so impactful. So when localities or any jurisdiction takes on an issue that's new and learns from their work, shows feasibility, identifies challenges, and then that initiative can spread to other localities or other jurisdictions, that is really the promise for changing these factors in our food system overall.
Last question, where can our listeners go to kind of to follow your work and continue to?
Everyone can follow our work through our social media channels at NYC Healthy, Instagram, Twitter, and we're in the news from time to time. Our website, of course, as well.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's really fun to be here, and congratulations on all the great work you've done with the podcast since you took it over.
This is our 141st episode.
That's incredible.
I know.
That's incredible. Congratulations to you.
I was going to, well, and you. You know, you started it. And you did a lot.
You've done by far the vast majority of those of that 140 episodes. So.
I wanted to wait till 150, but I was like, I can't wait that long. I need to have her on now. Well, thank you so much for joining. Okay, so we're going to leave it there, but before we go, I want to give a big thanks to our sponsors for their generous support, as well as to Devaney Latino, Eating Matters intern extraordinaire, and our engineer. Show music is by Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast wherever they are found. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe and leave me a comment. Let me know what you think. I'm Jenna Liu, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.